Hello, listeners. This is David Blakesley, and I am back with episode 56 of the Criterion Reflections podcast. For those of you who listen to these episodes soon after they're first published, you may have noticed I've been gone for a little while. A little travel time, a little scheduling issues, and just kind of getting back into the routine of things here. It's been almost 2 months since I've released a new episode, but I'm very happy to be back at it. And for those of you who maybe just found this episode because you're particularly interested in a podcast about Tales of Beatrix Potter, I apologize for the unnecessary preambles there, and just letting you know that we're recording this in early August of 2019 as I resume my chronological exploration of the Criterion Collection involving not only films released on disc, but also, as in this case, films released on Criterion Channel, their streaming digital video service that's available to us fortunate viewers here in the United States of America, and perhaps someday other parts of the world. I agree. I really would love to see this service go global. But as we get into this episode about Reginald Mills' 1971 film, Tales of Beatrix Potter, I am very happy to be joined by a new guest, Peter Webb. Peter, you are over in England. You are over in Beatrix Potter territory. So I'm very eager to have you.
That's part of why I wanted to be on this episode, really, because I think there's stuff I can contribute from that.
I'm very sure that you will, and I'm so pumped up to hear what you have to say about this very intriguing and beguiling and charming film. So, Peter, you know, like I like to do with new guests, first timers on at least on my podcast, tell us a little bit about yourself. It's very great to make your acquaintance. Mm-hmm. We've been engaged in social media for a while now. You're a pretty active contributor to a number of different Criterion themed groups, as well as other cinema projects. You're a blogger, mm-hmm. and just a creative person in general. So tell us a little bit about yourself, and we'll get the conversation going.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's that much that's exciting. Maybe other people can disagree, but I'm interested in writing about film. Obviously, I'm interested in film as well. I'm interested in photography, a lot of stuff with queer culture and queer theory. I find it kind of hard to sum myself up, but that's kind of the stuff that I'm into. And I've been into Criterion for a while. I've been into the podcast for a while. And obviously in the UK, it's more limited with how much Criterion we have compared to the States, but mm-hmm. I'm still really into the community and the films within it and all of that.
Well, it's really great. So what part of the UK do you actually live in?
So I'm in Norwich, which mm-hmm. Compared to the Lake District, where all the Beatrix Potter stuff is, it's like maybe a 5 or 6 hour drive. So it's quite a different part of the country. But there is a few Criterion connections with Norwich, because 45 years, there's some scenes in that film which are shot in Norwich.
Mm-hmm.
And I still haven't seen that film.
Well, you're giving me a place and a location, which is certainly, it's not London, and it's not the Lake District. It's something different.
The other notable films to do with Norwich is Fighting With My Family, which just came out this year. And, it's about this whole real life family from Norwich. Mm-hmm. And there's also all the Avengers films since 2015, the whole Avengers headquarters they've got, which, in the film is in Greater New York. They actually shot part of that in Norwich, in the Sainsbury Centre in the University of East Anglia, which, you know, they've got stuff like paintings by Francis Bacon and whatever there, but they just use this part of the exterior for Age of Ultron, and then I think with like the visual effects, they've just borrowed that part of the university campus and then just matted in all this stuff from New York and different places. So that's quite interesting.
Well, I'm going to maybe age myself a little bit here. When you first said the Avengers, I was thinking of the old Diana Rigg, Patrick McNee TV series, which would be pretty cool in itself. So,
well, yeah, I like the Avengers as well.
Of course, yeah, the original Avengers, right. Well, it's great to have you on, and I am, like I say, pretty happy to introduce a new voice, and yeah, definitely really appreciate your writing, your insights, and your perspective. So thank you for joining me. You know, I added this one to my queue a few months back because the Criterion Channel introduced Tales of Beatrix Potter as part of their Saturday matinee series on the Criterion Channel. This was a streaming-only option, so for people who are into the Criterion Collection's physical media side, you might wonder, why would I even talk about this? But I cover it all, whether it's coming up on streaming, on Laserdisc, DVD, Blu-ray, whatever the case may be. If it's got the Criterion logo attached to it, we're going to talk about it. And so this is part of, I guess, their Saturday series, which is conceivably intended to be more family-friendly fare. And this one certainly is. I mean, we're talking about, you know, Beatrix Potter. She is a one of the most revered, classic, universally beloved authors and illustrators of children's books that I know of. I mean, the tales of Beatrix Potter, and particularly the tale of Peter Rabbit, Benjamin Bunny, and many others, and we're going to be talking about some of those particular stories as we get into this. They are canonical, you know, children's literature. Yeah, as I speak today, I'm just a couple days away from my granddaughter's first birthday, so we are not quite at the book reading stage yet. You know, she's a little pre-verbal, but she is walking around and she's doing interesting stuff. But I am so giddy with anticipation at the idea of reading these stories to her. But I'll also have to say that this film kind of forced my attention upon the works of Beatrix Potter, because I'll just have to admit, I kind of took them for granted. I had not really focused, you know, clearly and squarely on her work. This goes all the way back to my childhood, which was back in the 1960s now. I was more of an Edward Lear guy, if you want, you know, as far as, you know, Victorian era children's literature is concerned. He was the author of the Book of Nonsense, the Limericks, and The Owl and the Pussycat, and many others. And then you can also throw in Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. So Beatrix Potter, well, that was kind of girl stuff as far as I was concerned. And, you know, even though I've raised four children to adulthood, I don't know that I ever really sat down and read these stories as closely as now I believe they clearly deserve. And it was this film and its adaptation of the incredible illustrations and the very whimsical, beautiful stories that Beatrix Potter told that really got me to take a fresh look at this publishing phenomenon and the very interesting person behind it all. So, Peter, tell me, what has your experience of Beatrix Potter been up until this point?
So, I think one of the reasons I really wanted to do this episode is Beatrix Potter is a writer that I've grown up with, and it's always been like the family thing to visit the Lake District, and kind of, not quite annually, but like every other year, kind of visiting the area, the National Trust properties. I'm sure there's so much Beatrix Potter stuff there, which I'm sure we'll get into later in the episode as well. But it's even just having like gift shops and the properties that she lived in, where you can see manuscripts and illustrations. And she is kind of like a writer that I've taken for granted, in the sense that when you consume something in childhood, you can enjoy it, you can even dislike it, but you're not so much looking at it through the framework of what themes were covered, was this enjoyable, what things did it approach. It's just kind of something which feels like, oh, this is something that a writer decades ago, this is something that this writer from long before my lifetime came up with just out of nowhere. This is just a thing that exists. And I think part of my response to this film was kind of thinking more of why have these stories become so loved and popular, and what elements are in there?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they're kind of just part of this cultural wallpaper, I might call it, where, you know, Beatrix Potter, she's always been there. It's cute. It's adorable. It's very skillfully rendered. I mean, even as a kind of, you know, fairly distant observer, I was aware of these characters as long as I can remember. And, you know, the books and the, you know, the commercialization, if you will, mm-hmm. has been kind of, you know, something in my kind of broader frame of reference for most of my life. I can't specifically say there was a time I didn't know about Beatrix Potter, but I was not especially drawn to it until this film, because of my kind of ongoing interest, my scholarly and fan-driven attraction to sort of understand all things Criterion, said, okay, well, if I'm going to do a podcast about this film, since now it's shown up on the channel, I better understand the background. And my daughter, who's a pretty prolific, you know, she works in the manga industry. She okay. letters graphic novels, and as they're translated from Japanese into English, she does the English lettering, and she's very, very good, and she's very successful, and she's, you know, got quite a nice little career going for her. But she's also a very vociferous and acquisitive children's book collector. She has a very impressive library of children's literature going back to, you know, the late 1800s. I mean, she goes to library rummage sales and buys up volumes, and she's got a really great eye for the unique styles and artistic, you know, genius of different eras of children's book illustration, as well as, you know, the authorship. And so she's lent me a couple of books, including one published by Frederick Warren and Company, mm-hmm. Beatrix Potter, The Complete Tales, a nice slipcase hardcover edition with, you know, nice, it's a nice oversized book where you really can see the incredible detail that Beatrix Potter put into her work. And then you kind of do a little biographical search, you know, read the Wikipedia page and a few of the websites dedicated to what she does. And it's like, she's a very remarkable woman. She was brought up in this kind of cloistered Victorian environment, a daughter of privilege. I mean, her father was wealthy, and there were a lot of comforts that she was given access to, you know, summer vacations and all of that. But she was not an idler by any chance. She was very observant, very keen eye, and because she was kind of kept a little bit segregated from social life, she found her outlet, her creativity, in observing nature. Not only drawing the animals that, of course, she's well regarded and beloved for, but even, you know, flora and fauna and landscapes and just the basic scenery of nature. And, you know, as I stopped and really took a look at what she did, it's like, this is really fantastic. And it wasn't necessarily done for purely exploitive commercial purposes. This was a passion project. She had a fondness for little animals, and a lot of her earliest work were like picture letters. She would write correspondence to nephews and nieces and loved ones of all sorts, and in between her little paragraphs of prose, she would have little pictures that she drew, and that's really the origins of her stories, which became this big sensation in the early parts of the 20th century. And it's out of all that that this amazing body of work was established and has really persevered for, you know, the century plus ever since, which kind of leads us to this film, which is, I'll tell you what, Peter, do you want to tell us, what is this movie about? Is this, give us your impressions. How do you lead us into Tales of Beatrix Potter, the movie?
I didn't really have any expectations going into this. When I was growing up, I think the only Beatrix Potter adaptation I might have been exposed to was the cartoon series that was made in the 90s. But otherwise, I wasn't really aware of the adaptations. I was just aware of the books themselves. So I had no idea what to expect from this. I just saw some pictures from the DVD artwork. I saw some, you know, I probably saw maybe a few pictures of it from just searching around, but I didn't really know how it would be done, what method of anything. I don't even think I was even aware that it had anything to do with ballet until I was reading the back cover. And I was like, oh, this has got ballet in it. So it's I would say it's kind of not, if you don't know anything about Beatrix Potter, it might just make you not want to know anything about her. Just because yes. if you don't know anything about this film going into it, because I think the one thing that surprised me is it's a silent film. And
other than the music, yeah, there's lots of music. Yes. It's a ballet with orchestra. The whole thing, mm-hmm. Right?
And I came across one of Fritzi Kramer's reviews recently, which you probably know from...
Oh, sure. Movie Silently, yeah, and part of the 25th frame and all that. Did she do a review of this film?
Well, no, I don't think so. But she did a review.
I'll link it if she did.
She did a review of the Shaun the Sheep movie, where she was basically arguing.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, you could say that this isn't a silent film, but because it doesn't have spoken dialogue, because there's music, it fits the criteria that some of the later Murnau and Chaplin films, which had synchronized sound in, it still fits within that.
Yeah, there's a dedicated soundtrack, not an accompaniment score that's performed by an organist or a quartet or whatever off to the side, right?
Yeah, so it is kind of a completely different form of filmmaking if you're just used to actors speaking their dialogue and portraying their scenes. And that was something I unfortunately, you say you've got a massive volume of her work.
It's right here in my hand at the moment. So it's probably a good couple hundred pages or so.
Yeah. So
395 pages. Okay. If I flip to the end there. So yeah, it's everything.
So I had a massive volume of her work when I was growing up, but I was kind of the person, as soon as I hit puberty and being a teenager, I was like, well, all of these children stuff, I don't need this anymore. I'll just clear this out.
It's rubbish. It's embarrassing. Yeah. We don't want to be identified with this kid stuff anymore, of course.
So I had like a massive volume of her work, and I don't have that anymore. But I did have, I do still have like this 100-page book, which has a couple of her stories, which I kind of appreciate having a quite a small volume, because in the sense that when they originally published, it was just these short stories, maybe 20, 30 pages with some illustrations.
Oh, yeah. At least half of the pages were pictures, you know, just with little snippets of text on the opposite page. You know, that was definitely her early style. Some of the later tales became a little bit more verbose. Some of the illustrations are just black and white sketches or lithographs. So, you know, when you get the whole thing collected and under one volume, you definitely see some artistic growth and evolution going on, which is also pretty fascinating. But, you know, that the further you get into that, the farther you get away from this film, which is really a visual interpretation in dance, in music, and in, you know, the set pieces and the masks, the costumes. I wonder if that's not the most remarkable thing about this film. I mean, there are quite a few things that are there to admire. So I'll say that I am basically an enthusiastic fan of this film. However, let me throw out the caveat that if you haven't taken some time to immerse yourself in the world of Beatrix Potter, or if you're just so enamored of her stories as narratives with illustration, you may find this the most tedious and pointless exercise of film watching that you've encountered in a while. So I'm not gonna give this a universal recommendation across the board, because there are probably maybe even some listeners who are gonna say thanks but no thanks to this. However, I do say give it a chance and let that little long-suppressed child come out and enjoy this very unique interpretation of stories that, at least for some of us, might be pretty familiar, or they may be very delightful new discoveries, which is probably more my case than the former.
I found some very enjoyable negative reviews when I was reading up about this. If you'd like to hear a couple of the Letterboxd reviews I found.
Hey, sure. Yeah, let me hear it.
Okay. So one of these is from someone called Lemonsky, where they basically said, "I've walked out of two movies in my life, and Tales of Beatrix Potter was one of them. I don't even know how I came to see it in a theater. It was in the early 80s and was in a double bill, because no one would be stupid enough to see it by itself. Just think, in 1971, you could have spent your movie-going dollar on Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Imagine the dark look on kids' faces when their parents took them to see this instead. The horror and disgust of having to sit through it, and the shame of possibly being seen by their school friends coming out of it. Let this be a public service message. This is one of the worst movies ever made, and I endured it for you, dear readers." And there was another very enjoyable bad Letterboxd review from Per Hasselstrom, who said, "Revisited this movie for the first time since I was around 7 years old. They used to show this every December 23rd here in Sweden. What an incredibly cruel movie to show to children. A true abomination. Highly recommended as a study of what we used to do to our young."
Child abuse of the 70s illustrated. Well, here's the thing. You do have to have a tolerance for rodents and amphibians and assorted wildlife mincing about in the most absurd positions. And again, without any narrative support, it's not always really clear what story is being told. I did spend some time. I can't say I read through all 395 pages of my Complete Tales of Beatrix Potter, because there's probably about, I don't know, somewhere between 7 and 10 of the stories that are at least referenced in this film, and she wrote quite a few more than that. And interestingly enough, they didn't really do Peter Rabbit, you know, Farmer McGregor, and you know, all of the, you know, that's probably the most, you know, revered and canonical of all the classic stories. They kind of made Peter Rabbit more of a supporting character, kind of an outside observer. along with Mrs. Tiggy Winkle, the hedgehog, who kind of just runs into the screen, gets us started, has a little domestic scene where she's doing some ironing and a few household chores, and then she exits and leaves us, and that's the end of the film. But other than that, you probably do need to have a little bit of exposure, whether that's recent reading or at least standing memories from years gone by, so that these stories actually make some kind of sense. And well, let's talk about the director. Let's get back. You know, we often give kind of prominence of place to the auteur behind all of this, and this is one of those classic one and done directorial efforts. Reginald Mills only directed one movie, and this is it. So, what do you know about Reginald Mills?
I don't really know that much about him. I know he was involved as an editor with Powell and Pressburger, but that's kind of, that's really all I know about him. I've not really
thought
much about Mills.
But that in itself is pretty major. He was the editor for A Matter of Life and Death, The Red Shoes, and Black Narcissus. So that, those three films right there, I mean, if you want to have a brief resume, I can't think of too many that would be, topping above that from the editor's perspective. Those are three great, incredible masterpieces. He also was pretty involved with Franco Zeffirelli, who did Romeo and Juliet and Jesus of Nazareth and Brother Sun, Sister Moon. So he seemed to have moved from the Powell and Pressburger camp, and then somewhere kind of maybe after that fell apart in the late 40s, early 50s, transitioned on. But he is a very gifted editor, and that was his claim to fame. And just the association with some of these really classic and epic productions, I think, that's a pretty nice legacy to leave behind. Somehow or other, he became part of this and was actually asked to sit behind the camera. And so what we have here in Tales of Beatrix Potter is a, for the most part, a very studio-bound production. There are those introductory scenes where Mrs. Tiggy Winkle is very clearly running across a real open field in the Lake District. And there may be a few other scenes that were filmed out of doors to kind of give us a little bit of the context of lakes, ponds, woodlands, etc. But everything else is very much within a very artificial environment. But again, I referenced earlier the costuming of these characters, which have a incredibly uncanny resemblance to Beatrix Potter's illustrations, and I think one of the, let me ask your thoughts on this. I mean, to me, the magic of Beatrix Potter's illustrative style as an artist is that she has this really wonderful blend of true to life and anatomy and kind of the physiology of these small creatures, mice and frogs and hedgehogs and piglets and all of that. But then she puts them in this kind of anthropocentric situation with little clothing and slippers and tights and knickers and all of that. And it's very convincing, I mean, mice really cannot adopt the posture that she puts them in, but it feels, as you're reading the book, very plausible. And the thrill of watching the ballet is that these characters, or these dancers, I should say, are doing some pretty nice footwork and body work within these very cumbersome outfits. Yes. and so you have to really appreciate the craft and the tenacity of this whole production. This is not an easy thing to pull off, and yet they make it look very playful and graceful and natural.
I feel like the litmus test of the film as to whether you're going to enjoy it or not enjoy it is with the costumes. Because my first reaction when I started watching the film and I saw Ness taking Winkle walk onto screen, all I could do was focus on just seeing the feet and being like, well, this is ridiculous. This is this is someone in a costume. They're not even trying to make this realistic or anything. And I don't really know anything about ballet, but I'm so used to seeing it kind of abstracted, like it's Julie Taymor's The Lion King, or I suppose Cats as well, where you get an impression of the character and maybe their personality, but you don't actually create the whole costume and everything. And I really don't, I'm kind of worried for these dancers somewhat, just because I'm sure it would be very, very intensive. And I did find that when they were staging this in the 90s, because it hadn't actually been on the stage before, it had only been a film, they actually, I think they went to the original costumes, they went to the original designers, and adapted those costumes for the stage, which I'm not sure if that would be better on the stage for the dancer, or if it's easier when it's a film and you get the breaks between scenes.
Yeah, you basically have to just do the one shot, then you can take the rest of the day off. Whereas, in a stage production, this is about an hour and a half film, and I'm sure you've got a whole crew of dancers, so they maybe have one or two scenes, maybe some have three or four if they're really featured players. So I suppose you can spread it out so that nobody gets completely burned out or exhausted, especially if you're doing, a matinee and an evening show every day or weekend or whatever the case may be. But yeah, this is a production that has had kind of a second life as a stage performance. And quite coincidentally, one of my friends here in Michigan saw a video clip and expressed an interest in seeing this on stage someday. And I said, well, as a matter of fact, it is available on film, and I'm going to be doing a podcast about it this weekend. So, so it is quite impressive that this oddball one-off production seems to have, created an ongoing tradition of sorts. Because, again, there are some elements of the appeal of the Beatrix Potter stories that don't exactly come through. Again, her wordplay and her sort of mild and genteel sense of irony, and that doesn't really come through here. The way that her stories, kind of unique to its time, don't really have a moralistic ending. She's not trying to teach lessons for pious young children here. She's just saying, sometimes life is hard and sometimes life is scary and sometimes things go okay. And her stories kind of have all of those elements. Peter Rabbit's father is famously winds up in Farmer McGregor's pie. And it's kind of an offhand reference there, but to any child who's paying attention, it's like, that's pretty horrible. But you don't get some of those more subtle touches here. In fact, a lot of this is kind of lampoonery or slapstick. The two bad mice as they break into the dollhouse and are smashing dishes. I mean, in a way, you get more of that kind of misconduct, that kind of naughty, rebellious behavior played out before you than even what you see in the book. So there are some ways that this film expands upon the stories. And then there are other parts that are left out because they don't quite fit the scheme of a enacted dance depiction, And so to me, it does feel like if you don't have some kind of investment in the world of Beatrix Potter, this film is not really going to pay off.
I feel like as well, like with the stories where they're quite short, I don't usually advocate for splitting a film up into different parts because usually that destroys the momentum of it. But I think this is a film where if, say, you're looking after a child and they don't have the longest attention span, then you can just put a 10-minute section on and they will get a complete narrative out of that. Because it is kind of a hard film to describe in that it doesn't really have a conventional narrative where this happens and this happens and this happens. It's like this set piece and then this set piece with these completely different characters, this another set piece, and then all the characters are together at the end.
Yeah, right. There's kind of that big grand finale where everybody comes out and does their little turn in the spotlight there. But there's other pieces that leading up to that, again, if you don't really know the story, what even makes sense here? I think it almost feels kind of like a prelude to the grand finale where you've just got a whole bunch of mice prancing around and it doesn't exactly make sense. Like, what's going on here? You know, the Jeremy Fisher, the dancing leaping frog, that makes sense. The two naughty mice, I've already referenced that. Piglet Bland, I think you kind of get what's going on there too. So some of these stories, it would be nice to have this on disc. I would love to be able to read the story to my granddaughter maybe a year from now and say, okay, let's watch this on movie now and let's see how they did and see if she gets into that. But otherwise, it's kind of like you're just kind of out there on a limb without having a lot of frame of reference of what's going on. But I don't know, it's still a lot of fun. I'm on board with it. And again, some of the dancing, I guess, you know, you said you're not, you know, deeply into ballet, nor am I. But because this particular set of dance sequences and the music does have a kind of a focal point in stories that I have, you know, somewhat recently kind of bonded with. Now all of a sudden I've got, okay, yeah, this makes sense to me. I do wonder what a ballet aficionado would think of this. Is this kind of a bastardization of the art form because of all the costumes and props and whimsical silliness of it? Or could they see this as a nice access point? Is this kind of a child's primer on ballet as an art form that might help lead them into an appreciation of dance as a form of narrative storytelling?
I think a lot of the credits at the beginning of the film, obviously you've got Reginald Mills in there, but then you also have a lot of the ballet related things listed, and obviously it can be easy to be like, this is a Reginald Mills film, this is the one film in the Reginald Mills directorial canon. But there was one quote that I found from one of the reviews that you linked in the show notes, where the Roger Greenspun review from the New York Times, and it's basically saying it's a filmed ballet. And the auteurs are more properly Frederick Ashton, choreographer, and John Lunchberry, the composer, rather than Reginald Mills or on Miss Potter, upon whose stories and marvelous illustrations the ballet is based, which I think there's probably some truth to in that. And I think it's a very visual film, which obviously makes sense when it's not so much to do with the dialogue. But there was, when I was reading through one of the stories that I have, the tale of Squirrel Nutkin.
Oh, yes.
So,
which is really, like, that's the last of the true tales that's brought out here. So that's kind of a culmination of the film. Go ahead.
So I noticed the one shot where it's kind of the squirrels going into the water and you see the color of the sky that's directly borrowed from the illustration in the book. And I'm sure some of the other scenarios in the film have taken the composition of the image straight from the original book.
Yeah, definitely. There's definitely a very high degree of fidelity here. The appearance of the characters and some of the details. There are certainly things that are left out. There are elisions where they kind of skip from one moment to the next as far as the Beatrix Potter's original text is concerned. But it makes sense if you think about the problems of working this out cinematically and theatrically, because again, the characters have to dance things out without the benefit of dialogue exchanges or anything like that. But I do want to give Reginald Mills what I consider due credit. I mean, his editorial involvement with The Red Shoes in particular, as a film really focused on ballet, not just the theatrical, production or the visual results we see on screen. Obviously, there's some really incredible sequences, some of the greatest passages in cinema history. Reginald Mills, his hands were very directly on that. And I think, for all the credit due to Powell and Pressburger, if they didn't have the technical support of people doing what Mills did to really cobble those scenes together, it wouldn't make the same impression. So again, I won't at all suggest Reginald Mills is one of the great directors, but his instinct, his eye, and his ability to say, here's how we're going to assemble this footage over the course of an entire film dedicated to ballet must be given due credit. So yeah, the choreography, obviously, the costume design, no doubt, Beatrix Potter's inspiration, hats off to her. But I think, Reginald Mills seems to have been a good candidate for this position, this responsibility for capturing this on film, and then apparently serving as the source inspiration for stage productions of decades hence. So if this is the one film you got to direct, and that's kind of how you've made your bread and butter, even the Zeffirelli films, I think I'll probably, if I ever get around to rewatching some of those, I may go ahead and try to look for the influence that Mills had in putting those lavish spectacles together. So yeah, to go from Powell and Pressburger to Franco Zeffirelli, that's a pretty interesting trajectory as far as I'm concerned.
It did get me thinking a bit about other people who have spun off into their own careers, like the Jack Cardiff, obviously yes, known as a cinematographer for Powell and Pressburger, but then he did direct a handful of films by himself. And I was also thinking with Wong Kar-wai, so much of his films are, they get their magic from having Christopher Doyle as cinematographer. And then he went off to do his own films as well. So I think it's really interesting. Like when you first come across a director, you go through the kind of the Powell and Pressburgers that everyone knows, like The Red Shoes and Colonel Blimp and Black Narcissus and some of the other ones.
Yeah.
But I think it's really interesting when you're kind of, you're in deep into a particular creative to kind of go off the different avenues that they spin off into and see some of the stuff that is not their film, but there's some connection to that.
Yeah. This appears to be kind of a late in the career work for Reginald Mills. Again, he's back in the early 40s with Powell and Pressburger. This is a good 30 years later. So perhaps a bit of a crown piece for him. But I think it's a nice one. It's a nice bit of a handoff to a future generation. This clearly does seem to be made as a family entertainment film. Obviously, some of those Letterboxd reviews you quoted earlier, not every child dragged into this appreciated it. And that's probably as much attributable to the compulsory nature and that treacly sweetness. Again, if you're, I go back to my own childhood. I knew about Beatrix Potter, but I was more interested in sarcasm and irony and absurdity. And this just felt sugary sweet and sentimental and perhaps a little bit on the trite and cute side. And yet I'll write that off as an early manifestation of male chauvinism on my part. There's real beauty here, and there's humanity, and there's gentle humor, gracefulness, but also some real strength. I maybe want to circle back to my very favorable impression of Beatrix Potter, the person, you know, the woman herself, who, again, had a lot of opportunities, privileges, and sumptuous senses. I mean, she was clearly the child of a very prosperous household, and yet she created something quite remarkable and beautiful and splendid that has been enjoyed by children, I would assume, of very many nations for many, many years, the nearly 120 years since The Tale of Peter Rabbit was first published in 1902. She has brought absolute delight and joy into so many lives, not only the lives of children, but parents who get to share these stories with their kids or grandchildren, as I'm looking forward to someday. So, you know, this is a nice little object here. It's not exactly what you would consider your typical Criterion movie, but it is a real treat, and I think at least worth a spin for anybody who's maybe not seen it yet, but has been intrigued by our words.
I would say that it deserves its place in the collection, whether it's on streaming or on a disc, because when I was going through all the Criterion releases, they've done a good job with films that are about childhood that are for adults, but they've also done a very good job for films that children and families can enjoy, and giving it that critical perspective and kind of showing, okay, this might be a film that you watched as a child, but it still has a lot of value and things that went into it. I think especially films like Watership Down, which I think is quite similar to this in that there's the anthropomorphism, and it's also quite a dark film, which I would say this film has some elements of.
It certainly does. I mean, it's not going to be, you know, the bloody violence of Watership Down. It's not, you're not going to see animals, you know, suffering in the same sense, but it is a lead up to that. It is definitely not just, you know, goofy commercial caricatures. And in fact, I lament the fact that Peter Rabbit's most recent cinematic incarnation is just garbage. I mean, I've only seen the trailers, all I can say, but there was a 3D CGI version where he's a little smart-talking, sassy 21st century post-millennial kid, and it's like, no, you don't really need to do that with this character, but it's a brand at this point, and I'm sure somebody got the rights and decided they're going to, you know, modernize it. But I really do enjoy the faithfulness to the spirit, if not the letter.
Well, some of the things that I found out when I was researching is, at least within the UK, Beatrix Potter is now in the public domain. I don't know what the case is for the United States.
It seems like Frederick Warren and company still have a pretty tight control on publishing, but maybe not. I don't know. That's a great question.
Well, the Frederick Warren is, at least for a while, it's been part of the Penguin Group.
Okay.
As every single UK publisher seems to be.
Yeah,
because it's like Penguin, Random House, or whatever.
Yeah, they've just absorbed everything, but they want to keep the distinctive imprint for nostalgia's sake, if nothing else, right?
Like, there hasn't been that many Beatrix Potter adaptations, but I think you'll be seeing so many more especially if they don't have to pay anyone to do so.
Yeah, yeah. If you could just use the name Benjamin Bunny, you know, all of that, Jeremy Fisher, Squirrel Nutkin, all of that. Yeah, yeah. It's kind of a tempting, juicy target to take the name, the image, and then run with it wherever you will.
But I do think Peter Rabbit is so associated with Beatrix Potter. Like, I'm pretty sure as a kid I had all the soft toys of Peter Rabbit and all of that. And I think when this was released in the States in the 70s, it was called Peter Rabbit and the Tales of Beatrix Potter, which is kind of a misnomer considering
it really is
how little is in it. But you know, you've got the cartoon series where Peter Rabbit played quite a big role from what I'm aware, and you've got the most recent film, and even like the Beatrix Potter website, so much of it is Peter Rabbit that I think you can forget about the other stories and the themes behind the stories when so much of it is focused on Peter Rabbit. And I honestly don't know if someone in the future wants to do any of the other stories of Beatrix Potter. Would they kind of get a response like, well, everybody knows Peter Rabbit, why do you want to do this other Beatrix Potter story? Let's just do the one that everybody knows about.
It's kind of like C.S. Lewis. Everybody knows Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, but then there were a whole series of other books that came along after that. But there is that kind of first launch, and Peter Rabbit was her first book. And it's very brief. It's very slight compared to some of the later works. And yet that's the one that everybody knows. It is kind of interesting. I won't call Beatrix Potter a one-hit wonder, but her first book was the one that created the biggest splash and endures to this day. I think there are many other really delightful tales. And, you know, no knock against Peter, but I think there's other dimensions to explore here. And it is very fascinating that this film, I have to think, very deliberately decided they're not going to reenact that particular story, the story of Peter Rabbit getting into, you know, Farmer McGregor's garden and all of that. Probably because at the time that was so universally known, they decided that they're going to bring attention to other stories instead. And I also like that. I like the fact that they took a path of greater resistance. They didn't just go for the easy commercial exploitation. They were kind of talking to the Beatrix Potter heads out there.
Well, I think also it keeps the human characters to the sidelines where they're not really present.
Yeah, yeah.
You still get some of their presence, and you've got the sequence quite early on after the opening where you see Beatrix Potter, and there's quite, it almost feels like it could become a chamber drama, like just from the whole setup of seeing kind of the dining table and the dark lights and people working on the food.
The domestic servants and her parents kind of lurking in the background. This very cloistered upbringing. I really appreciate those scenes, although they're kind of easy to either miss or overlook or even forget about once the animals return to the screen and take full stage. But I think they do a nice job of sort of hinting at, if you will, the deprivations, and I use that word very advisedly. She didn't suffer, but she was not allowed to openly interact with many of her peers. She was kind of confined in many respects, and that fed into her incredible talent. But there was also, I'm sure, a loneliness that she had to experience as a result of all that.
And I'd also say, like, the Lake District it's almost kind of a, I wouldn't call it a lonely place, but it's quite, I suppose it's quite individual in that every time that I've visited, it's walking across these great landscapes, and I wouldn't really call it solitude, but it is kind of a place you can go into your own thoughts and reflect and not really have that much contact with other people.
That's very interesting. I do wonder, like, here in the United States there are, and even in Canada I imagine there are places that are tourist attractions because of their association with a famous personality. And I do wonder, I mean, what you're, the picture you're kind of portraying here is that you can go to the Lake District, you can go to the Beatrix Potter locations, mm-hmm. Hilltop Farm and all of that, and see the places where she hung out and did her work, but maybe it's not just swarming with mobs and throngs of tourists with their bright shirts and cameras around their necks and all of the kind of cliches of tourist traps. Is that an accurate description? Is it still kind of got a little bit of that?
I mean, it's been a while since mm-hmm. I've done kind of the Beatrix Potter stuff there, but there's definitely kind of the literary aspect to it, because you've got people like William Wordsworth who...
Oh, yeah, sure. Others in that region, right?
Yeah, where you can also visit the places they were inspired by and where they lived. So I would say you definitely get the touristy stuff there. And I've only experienced the area as a tourist, but I know you probably do get the touristy swarms at some part of the year, but I wouldn't say that it's kind of overwhelmed by that.
It's good to know. I would not mind being one of those tourists myself someday. It seems like a really delightful area to visit, and my wife and I, I'm sure, would have a wonderful time exploring those environments. Are there any other bits of this film, any scenes, or any other notes you took that you want to make sure we get in before you wrap things up?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the aspects I noticed was the darkness of it. She did actually have, when she was growing up, she had a copy of the Brothers Grimm tales, which are obviously known to be quite dark themselves. Yes, and indeed. I think a lot of the stuff which you don't really understand in childhood, but you understand when you're older, about animals being eaten and kind of the immense threat and danger, which I think it's even more noticeable in the books, because with the story of Squirrel Nutkin, you've got the scene where they're giving the offerings to the owl, Old Brown, and
placating him, basically, mm-hmm. trying to sort of buy off some of his savagery.
and so in the film you see one of the Squirrel Nutkin basically grabbed into his clutches and then basically runs away, no longer having a tail. And in the book it explicitly says that Old Brown intends to skin this poor squirrel. Mm-hmm. And I think in the film it's less obvious. You could read it differently than Old Brown is trying to skin him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's clutched and he's taken off and he disappears for a moment, and the other squirrels are kind of shaking their heads and peering around the corner wondering what's going to happen. And then, you know, happily enough, Squirrel Nutkin, pops out of from behind the trunk there, and Yeah, he doesn't have his tail any longer, but it doesn't have that same sense of palpable danger that you have in the original story.
Right? And one of the other stories I found very, very dark was the Tale of Samuel Whiskers, where basically it's a very anxious cat, Tabitha Twitchit, who loses her kittens who go up to all sorts of mischief, and then they run into these rats that intend to turn them into roly-poly, and they try to kill, or they basically try to roll Samuel Whiskers up in dough and and cook him alive, and it really is quite dark, and yeah, that's one of the impressions that I got from the film. I'd say other films as well, or stories as well, like with, I'd say, like Charlotte's Web or Animal Farm or Babe, or just any film for children where it's dealing with animals and a farm. I'm coming at this film as a vegetarian, and that wasn't something that I was as a child. That's more something coming from adulthood, and it does kind of make you rethink these situations where it's like, okay, why are these animals here? What is the fate of these animals? And you do get the sequence with Jemima Puddle Duck.
Oh yeah,
she's being
the fox. Right.
Yeah, with the fox, and he's got like his whole recipe that is trying to cook.
And yeah, even a barely literate child can pick up what's going on here, and it really is scary because Jemima is a charming, appealing character. She's kind of fun and a little bit ditzy and waddling around looking to lay her egg. And there's Mr. Fox kind of wringing his paws and giving her those little cockeyed glances there. And you can tell his intentions are completely, you know, menacing and malignant toward her. And yet, you know, she's just playing right into his hands. I mean, there's from a child's perspective, there's definitely some suspense and dread going on here as we wonder what's going to happen to Jemima's eggs when she lays them.
Mm. And also the sequence with the mice where they go into the doll's house, it feels quite ironic. And
it's very anarchic. It's very violent. I mean, it's kind of like when Tom and Jerry, the old cartoon characters, used to like, you know, shove dynamite in each other's mouth and blow each other up. It's just like, wow, you know, if it's a parent who's really paying attention to what's going on here, it's like, oh, these are not exactly the best role models for my children.
It's like, it's almost like they went to the whole dining set expecting there to be their meal, and then they find out, oh no, this is just crockery, this is just this is just a toy.
Well, any child who's ever bitten into a piece of wax fruit because they were fooled into thinking this is a nice juicy apple, they can relate. It's like, what is this? I had that experience as a kid many years ago. So it's just that sense of grown-ups messing with me or something like that.
And I can't remember which parts of it, but I'm sure there's some parts where you get the sense that there are the farmers out there who, you know, are going to do what they will to these animals.
Well, yeah, these animals are kind of low on the food chain, I guess is one way of putting it. And they're so common as to be expendable. Mice, pigs, rabbits, frogs. I mean, you know, if one of them turns up missing, it's not like anybody's really going to notice, right?
Mm.
And so, you know, but children in their own sense of vulnerability, smallness, weakness against the larger, mysterious, menacing forces of this world, I think they find a bond with these simple characters. And yet, you know, somebody like Jeremy Fisher with his incredible leaps. I mean, I really, that's probably the performance that stands out the most to me. That guy, whoever that was, really had some legs. You know, he could get his body up there and make it float for a moment. And I really, really enjoyed that particular sequence because that sense of freedom and that explosive thrust off the ground was really kind of electrifying. And so there is some beautiful work being done here by the performers themselves.
I think as well the thing that really took me with the film was the colors within it.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Because as you were saying, earlier you have the opening and also the closing of films, where the closing of the film, where it's outdoors and the green seems really vivid, and you get that sense of the colour really early on. And even when it's more stage bound and maybe doesn't look as good as it will when it's outside, you still get the differentiation of the colours, where it's like you've got different characters for each of the different mice, so you can tell which character that you're following. With Jemima Puddle Duck, you've got her pink shawl and the pink flowers around her, and it really does stand out later on when it's indoors and you can see the orange half of the flame just lighting the room, and I feel like some of the colors are quite muted in the film. They're not the most vivid colors. You get greens and browns from nature, but it still stands out quite well. And
I think they're the same hues that Beatrix Potter used. I mean, her books are not especially bright and vivid. You know, they're kind of muted, and I mean, they're aesthetically incredibly pleasing and very finely rendered. I mean, you can sit and look into the details of just about every image, especially the paintings, and just be kind of breathtaking and awestruck by how nicely rendered they are. But they don't dazzle the eyes in terms of their brightness or their vividness, in terms of, you know, popping colors and all of that. I mean, they're kind of, you know, they are drawn from nature, and they are kind of in those kind of somewhat, you know, muted browns and greens and grays, those nature tones. So again, I think the cinematography and the treatment of the color stock is very much in keeping with the source material. I think it was a very aesthetically proper choice, and what I wouldn't give to see a modern day Beatrix Potter adaptation that was willing to kind of educate its youthful and family audience in not bold primary colors, but, you know, kind of offset colors that are just a little bit more, not sepia toned exactly, but willing to, you know, not take every advantage of the technological you know, possibilities that are rendered by today's 3D and CGI artistic tools.
And also, even the idea of having color in there, when Beatrix Potter was writing Peter Rabbit, she only did black and white illustrations. And it was then the publisher who made her put the color in, which she didn't really want to at first, but then she ended up doing that. So it is kind of, even if she didn't intend initially to have the most fantastic colors, it's, I think it is part of it, and it is what probably interests children in the first place, to not only have the story, but see kind of these characters and the colors.
And these books that were very small, kind of hand-sized books for children's hands. I kind of like having the big edition myself, because my 50-something eyeballs don't exactly adapt to the little pint-sized books that are out there. But I do appreciate the fact that for young readers, and that, you know, kindergarten through maybe second or third grade, you know, that's a book that's made to their size, and I appreciate the intimacy of that scale. So, yeah, This is nice. Okay, well, this is probably a good time to start winding things down. Any last words? I mean, it sounds like we're both ready to enthusiastically recommend this film with maybe a few caveats. But I'm really glad that I saw it, and I'm really delighted that Criterion decided to make it available on their streaming service.
Yeah, I'd say that I didn't. It's not a film that I'm massively connected with, but it's definitely something that I appreciated, and I'm glad I sat down and watched it. And I feel like it's almost like it could be a good midnight movie for someone who's like, I don't know, they want to watch something really, really weird, and they'll just they'll just sit down and watch this. But
it does.
Like I'm glad that it exists. Obviously there's different Beatrix Potter versions. And I kind of, even though I'm not perfectly convinced that it works completely, I think it's nice to have a version of the stories where it's tangible and it's not just the CGI animation where it's having something created in a computer combined with what's filmed in the Lake District. I think it's nice to have this version where you can see these characters moving about, and even when there's been the animated versions where it's 2D animation, I think it's really nice to see this version of the stories.
Yeah, I agree. It is an homage to Beatrix Potter in music, in dance. The music itself is also very nice. I've actually, because recording this podcast has been scheduling has happened in stages, and I've done different watches and rewatches. The film and the soundtrack in particular has become a kind of a pleasantly soothing kind of form of background texture for me. I've kind of gotten to know the music and the way it unfolds, and as a soundtrack, it's pretty nice, you know. So very relaxing, calming. There's a certain innocence and sweetness to this project that it is hard to envision a production of this sort making its way onto celluloid nowadays. I am heartened to know that at least maybe at some times recently and in some places of the world, there may be performers actually getting on stage and doing this for the amusement and entertainment of audiences. And if it ever showed up in my neighborhood, I'd probably drive a ways to go check it out myself. But it's been a real pleasure discussing this movie with you, Peter. Mm-hmm. And we will absolutely have you back on for some other films as we dig further into our archive of 1971 films and beyond. So tell listeners where they can get a hold of you. I've got some links in the show notes, but tell us a little bit about how we can access your work.
Yes, I'm active on a lot of places. Obviously, you'll probably come across my posts on the various Facebook groups, whether it's on Reflections or Criterion Now or the Gaia. I'm not so active nowadays, but I still post stuff on my blog, which is Musings on Films, which I will say it's not my preferred choice of a name for a blog, but it was the only one that was going. So it's like, yeah, I kind of like approaching stuff quite in depth and analytical.
Yeah,
but I do kind of like taking deep dives and kind of understanding how what something means or how it was constructed. I'm quite active on Twitter, I'm trying to think. I'll have some of my photography in the show notes. And some of the photos that I've got hosted on 500px is actually some photos that I took in the Lake District the last time I went there. There's nothing really to do with Beatrix Potter or anything, but you might be able to get a sense of the landscape and the sheep and all of that.
That's wonderful. Peter, it's really been nice making your acquaintance here on Skype and for giving you a chance to connect with our listeners here. And again, look forward to getting you back on here down the road. So thank you for your thoughts today. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. Glad to be back at it. I think our next episodes will pick up the pace a little bit. I don't think it'll be another 2 month wait between installments here. We'll be back soon. Our next episode is going to be Alan J. Pakula's film from 1971, Jane Fonda in Clute. So we'll be coming at you really soon with that. Take care, everybody, and goodbye.